of energy in atoms. Let's listen in.
What I want to do today is I want to work on using chemical lenses to observe nature at home. And I suppose the first thing we should ask is, well, why do we want to do this? And the why really comes from this idea that where we know more, we see more. Right? So if we can work on developing chemical lenses, hopefully we're going to see some different things. Now, some of you may already have a chemical lens. How many of you feel you have a chemical lens already?
Okay.
You're chemically challenged. All right. So some of you can dust off your lenses, take them out of the eyeglass case if you haven't used them for a while, and the rest of you will work together on building up your lens. So for the moment, you just want to think you have a pair of frames. That's good. Hi, come join us.
Just thinking.
All right, good. But after we get down the basics of a chemical lens, we'll work on developing two more focals so that we can look at Holden through those two additional focals. All right? And then, because we're at the end of the 20th century, we better stop at the end and ask ourselves some questions about what we're doing. And so we'll have a postmodern reflection on what we're doing. And then, since we're here at Holden, we should end by thinking for a few minutes about what this all means for this evening. Mm-hmm. All right? Okay, so I want you to reach down into your pocket and whatever and put on those lenses. For some of you, those lenses may just be empty frames at the moment. Some of you might want to wipe off your lenses. All right? And so to develop these lenses, what we do is we use some of the ideas that we've developed here at the end of the 20th century that help us explain nature. And the idea we use in chemistry, of course, is that according to our understanding and our models, everything is composed of atoms and molecules. All right. So right away, you didn't have anything in your frame. Now you can open your eyes, and there's this idea that everything, your human being, the ice cream you're licking, the seat you're sitting in, the wall over here, according to a chemist, all of that is atoms and molecules. We should, for a moment, clarify the difference here. Anybody have enough of a lens to help us with the difference between a molecule and an atom?
Molecules are bigger.
Molecules are bigger. In fact, molecules are composed of atoms. So if that's the case, then we can go back and use that old ancient Greek idea where a lot of this started, and that is that the atom is the smallest unit of material. And we should say parenthetically to a chemist. So we're not going to talk about a 20th century physicist idea. We'll just stick to the chemical ideas, which I think are probably a little more. So we're talking about taking matter and just chopping it up and chopping it up and chopping it up, chopping it up until we get down to the smallest unit of matter. I was over in Narnia today, and I was working with a 4 and 6 year old, and so we talked about the idea of what are things made of. And I had some grains of sand, and I said, see those grains of sand? That atom is smaller than the smallest grain of sand, right? So we're talking about a very small fundamental unit of matter. So the first thing you see with your lens is that everything is atoms and molecules. As you begin to focus a little more, you see that those molecules are composed of atoms, and then you can think of the atom, of course, as the smallest unit of material, of matter. All right? Someone mentioned on Monday they were reading a book called Sophie's World, where to this 10-year-old child, the world is explained as everything being composed of Lego blocks. Right? So if that helps your seeing a little bit more, you can think about that. And then just one final point here. To get us started, we can do the following. Usually, we use spheres to represent atoms. So how would we then get different atoms? How, if we're using spheres or balls to represent atoms, how would we characterize different atoms? How can we distinguish between these spheres?
Number of electrons.
Oh, you want to get right down in there and actually count the electrons, okay? That's fine. I was not going to get that sophisticated, so you must have a good pair of lenses there. How can we, if we just had a bunch of balls, how can we say that those balls are different?
Size.
Size would be one way, okay? What would be another way?
Composition,
all right? And so one way that the chemist usually distinguishes between the atoms is to use color, all right? So we could, actually our understanding of this is the hydrogen atom, it's actually a lot smaller than the carbon atom, but for some reason the manufacturers of models don't go to the trouble of making things relative to one another in terms of a size. So what we usually use is colored spheres to represent atoms, all right? So for those of you who have fairly well-established lenses, how many colors would we be looking at this point in history?
Almost 200.
It's a big number, right? And it gets bigger every day as the scientists get more sophisticated in their techniques. So there are lots of different, 111, 112, 113, 114, something like that, in terms of the different colors of spheres. However, when it comes to living things, we're only talking about a very small subset. So humans are actually composed of basically carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and some other things. But basically, all living things consist of just a small number of these colored spheres. All right. So then if we're going to use this visual model as a metaphor for atoms, if we have these colored spheres, then each sphere is an atom. And how do we usually symbolize then a molecule? How would you describe what we've done here to make a molecule? What have we done?
Stuck them together,
right? And usually this model set uses tubes to stick the atoms together. Sometimes we use sticks, all right? And remember that those sticks or tubes have what chemical name? Our chemists out there?
Bonds.
All right, so we say that, then we say atoms are bonded to form molecules. All right, now remember what we're trying to do is develop these ideas so that we can use them to see the world. And so I brought some of my models with us to help us a little bit. This is a model of a molecule you and I were just talking about a minute ago. This would be methane, a carbon with four hydrogen atoms surrounded by it. All right, so now if you close your eyes, open your eyes, and look through your chemical lens, all right, let's take a minute to look down at your hand. Your hand consists of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. So for a moment, you want to maybe zoom in on your hand and think about your atoms and molecules there in your hand. All right, to get us started. Kind of a new experience if you're not used to it, if it's not the way you usually look at the world. On Monday, we talked about maybe how hard it is to kind of shrink yourself down and imagine all those carbon atoms that are in your hand and what have you. That, as Carl Sagan would say, there are millions and billions of carbon atoms, hydrogen atoms, and so on down there in your hand. All right, so we really need to, it's kind of fuzzy, right? How is your lens right now? Fuzzy. It's not something you use very often, is it? In fact, most chemists, it takes quite a long time to develop a clear lens to see out. So let's work on enhancing your visual understanding just a little bit more, and let's take a moment to look at the carbon atom. So let's get a better picture of the carbon atom. If we could actually bring a carbon atom here and do a little dissection, what are we going to find in that carbon atom?
I don't recall.
You had part of it.
Well, electrons.
Electrons, all right. What else would we find in an atom?
Protons,
all right. And then there's one other thing.
Neutrons,
right? So it happens for carbon that it has six protons and six neutrons in the center of the atom. So you can imagine here, if we took this black sphere, which represents a carbon atom, and we cut it open, and we opened it up like a grapefruit, right? We find a hard core in the center, and that would be the nucleus. In fact, this is where most of the mass of an atom is right here in the nucleus. And then, anybody remember where those electrons go? Remember? From your grade school long ago? It's the same model, actually, that we're using. All right? It goes out and we have a cloud of two electrons that exist out around the nucleus. And then we have another shell, which has four more electrons in the outer shell. And so this is the shell model, or we can think of it as a Bohr model. This is named after the scientist. Or the shell model, or I like to use the metaphor of onion, that, you know, if you cut an onion down the middle and you open it up, you can see those shells, all right? So this would be a teeny tiny martini onion, right? It's a very small onion. It has only a small center of 6 protons and neutrons, a cloud of 2 electrons here, and then a cloud of 4 electrons. All right, so now, as you look down at your hand and you look at those carbon atoms, now they're different, right? Now they've got protons, electrons, and neutrons in them. Maybe you're seeing those tiny little martini onions. What are those martini onions called? They have a name. All right? But anyway, maybe you can think of your hand as being composed of those teeny tiny martini onions. Pearl onions. That's good. All right, well, I should say at this point, this is only one model that we have. This is really early 20th century model. We have a much more sophisticated model, which is a lot harder to work with in your mind. So we'll leave the quantum mechanical model behind. And today, we'll just stick with the idea that we can use the metaphor of onions for all our atoms. Okay? Some of them are great big onions, those are giant purple onions with lots of shells. Some of them are tiny onions, pearl onions like our carbon atoms. All right? Questions or comments about the model that we've developed so far for looking at?
How do they stick together? How do the atoms stick together to make molecules? How do they make bonds?
In the case of carbon, it makes its bond by sharing electrons. We kind of don't have time to, maybe we do a little more of that. Right? So we're really, there's a lot, you can go a lot deeper with your lens, which is why you spend a lot of time studying chemistry, because these are concepts that really you have to work with quite a lot. So we could answer that question if we had time, but for what we need to do today, what we can do is just stick with the onion model. Right? Now, I don't know about you, but you know, we live in a world right now that's very visual, right? We're just bombarded with media, and now multimedia, and CD-ROM, and all that stuff. So what I want to give to you today is another more visual model of this onion, all right? So what we're going to do here is we're going to shrink ourselves down into the size of a carbon atom, and we're going to take a trip from the outside of the carbon atom on in. And we're going to take a trip through these clouds of electrons till we hit the nucleus. All right, so I want you to maybe think for a moment about the landmarks along the way. So we're going to start out here with 4 and a cloud of 4. We're going to move through the cloud of 2. We're going to get here to the center of the atom. All right, and we're going to do this with the help of video, which is another one of those visual presentations that we have at this point in our history. And Mike, could you get the lights? We're actually going to start by looking at carbon in DNA, and we're going to move on through. So what I'd really like you to try to do as you look at this model is try to grab it for your own eye and your own head so that you can do this on your own. All right, so let's take a look here at the carbon atom.
By a form in motion becomes more visible. We focus on one commonplace group of 3 hydrogen atoms bonded by electrical forces to a carbon atom. 4 electrons make up the outer shell of the carbon itself. They appear in quantum motion as a swarm of shimmering points. At 10 to the minus 10 meters, 1 angstrom, we find ourselves right among those outer electrons. Now we come upon the 2 inner electrons held in a tighter swarm. As we draw toward the atom's attracting center, we enter upon the vast inner space. At last, the carbon nucleus. So massive and so small, this carbon nucleus is made up of 6 protons and 6 neutrons. We are in the domain of universal modules. There are protons and neutrons in every nucleus, electrons in every atom, atoms bonded into every molecule out to the farthest galaxy. As a single proton fills our scene, we reach the edge of present understanding. Are these some quarks in intense interaction? Our journey has taken us through 40 powers of 10. If now the field is 1 unit, then when we saw many clusters of galaxies together, it was 10 to the 40th, or 1 and 40 zeros.
So there we are, right in the nucleus. Let's watch one more time so that you can really get a concrete image in your mind. Whoops. in that space between the nucleus and the...
At last.
All right.
At the atomic scale, the interplay of form and motion becomes more visible. We focus on one commonplace group of three hydrogen atoms bonded by electrical forces to a carbon atom. Four electrons make up the outer shell of the carbon itself. They appear in quantum motion as a swarm of shimmering points. At 10 to the minus 10 meters, one angstrom, we find ourselves right among those outer electrons. Now we come upon the two inner electrons held in a tighter swarm. As we draw toward the atom's attracting center, we enter upon the vast inner space. At last, the carbon nucleus. So massive and so small, this carbon nucleus is made up of six protons and six neutrons. We are in the domain of universal modules. There are protons and neutrons in every nucleus, electrons in every atom, atoms bonded into every molecule out to the farthest galaxy. As a single proton fills our scene, we reach the edge of present understanding. Are these some quarks in intense interaction? Our journey has taken us through 40 powers of 10. If now the field is one unit, then when we saw many clusters of galaxies together, it was 10 to the 40th, or 1 and 40 zeros.
Right, why don't you take a minute to really focus in on that trip through the carbon atom? Maybe describe to each other what you saw as you sat on the outside of the carbon atom as you moved in. Why don't you... Maybe you could work in pairs or something like that. Just say it because if you say it, then it sticks in your brain in a different way. So take a minute to describe to each other what you see as you're traveling in through a carbon atom. Talk to one another.
That's traveling through space.
Okay, that's good. So what'd you see? What'd you see out here on the edge? It
looks like it's larger on the inside than on the outside.
Looks like it's larger on the outside than on the inside, okay? What you see when you're in that?
Mostly empty space in there.
There was a whole lot of empty space, wasn't it? Actually, it comes, there's a border between the cloud of two electrons. There's a border here at the end of the cloud of two electrons before you get to that nucleus, and that's where that empty space is. 2 powers of 10 of empty space. When you're sitting right down here in this cloud, what do we see visually on the screen in that cloud? What did you actually see on the TV screen when you were sitting right in here in this outer layer? Did you see the shimmering stuff?
Fuzzy motion.
Okay, that's symbolizing the electron motion. If we could put a little flashlight on each electron and watch it travel, it would sort of produce this. This is a metaphor for what we might be able to see if we could do something like that, right? So you had a cloud of shimmering, and as you traveled through this cloud, could you see the next cloud? Anybody catch that? That you can actually see the cloud that's coming up because this cloud is actually held more tightly, it's closer to the nucleus, so it's a little bit tighter. You can actually see the form of the two-electron cloud as you get closer to it. And since it's made of electrons, this is what you see. And then we enter that vast region of nothingness, so we saw that black. And then you see those six protons and neutrons there in the nucleus. Right? And we saw those as having a little bit different form because not only did we have the shimmer, but we had red and yellow and green and white. All right? So I think that's a sort of a different visual model of an atom than our onion. Right? It brings our onion out into three dimensions and actually gives it some life. All right? So now, take a minute to look down at your hand. Look at those carbon atoms in your hand. All right? You're going to have to focus on one, because can you imagine trying to, with your eyeball, capture all the carbon atoms in your hand? It'd be a little hard. So we try to move down in on one. All right. Well, there's a lot we could say about atoms and molecules. What questions do you have at this point? What would you like to know more about? What would you like to know more about in regards to these atoms and molecules? Mike wants to know about bonding, so we could, if we had time, look at that. What other things would you like to know about?
What keeps them from running into each other?
What keeps them from bumping into each other? Okay, that's a good question. Other things you might want to know about.
Why do we make them, say, atomic bomb, we split the uranium atoms, but why don't we split carbon? What's the difference?
That's a good question, which if I was a nuclear chemist, I might be able to help you with. I think it has something to do with the number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus.
Uranium has a much larger nucleus
made up of 235
protons and neutrons, so it can be broken down more readily.
Any other questions that come to your mind right now that you might like to know about, we could explore if we had enough time? I should tell you that the visual metaphor we have here, that you heard the tape say, we've reached the limit of our understanding. This is a 1970s picture. So in 20 years since this was made, we could travel inward and think about quarks and charms and some subatomic particles. All right, so I should just tell you that that's kind of a 1970s picture. All right. So, of course, there's lots that we could discuss to deepen your visual lens there. But as I promised, there were two particular focals I wanted to develop. And those two focals come from asking the question, what do atoms and molecules do? What are the behaviors of atoms and molecules? Any ideas? You think about chemistry, what do you think about happens? I don't know.
They react with each other.
They react with each other, and that's one thing that atoms and molecules do, is that they react, right? And I'm not going to talk about that fully today. I'm going to save that for another day. But just simply, if I had my methane molecule and I reacted it, it would involve this. All right, reacting really is nothing more than breaking and making bonds. So if we reacted methane with oxygen, what does it produce? If we combusted methane, what would we make?
Water.
Water?
Dioxide.
Water and carbon dioxide. So, oops. Which I just happen to have models for right here, right? If we combine the methane and we reacted it, which our chemist metaphor is collided, if we collided these oxygen atoms and these methane atoms together, we would produce, voila, carbon dioxide, CO2, and two water molecules. All right, so we've just broken the bonds that were here and here, and we made them into these molecules here and here. So reactions are really nothing more than breaking and making bonds. Let's just take a minute and think, well, how do we know when a reaction occurs? How do you know when a reaction has occurred? How do you tell?
When you've got something different.
When you have something different. So how could you tell if something is different? What senses might you use?
See.
You see? All right. So if we were to see a reaction happen, we often might get a color change. All right. How about smell?
You might have light.
You could see light coming off, like the phosphorescence of a bacteria in the ocean. How else might you know that a reaction is occurring? All right, you might feel heat. All right, when you turn up the heat in the wintertime and your natural gas heater in your house kicks on, what's going on and starts producing heat? You know that the methane in your system, in your house's system, is reacting, and bonds are broken and made. Any other senses we might be able to use? So we've got see, smell, feel. What other senses are left?
Might hear noise, might hear.
Like what kind of noise might we get?
Fizzing,
kaboom. So we can hear, sometimes we can hear reactions happening. All right, let's see, we're leaving out one more sense.
Taste.
All right, that if you can get a chemical change with the acid in your mouth, for example, have you ever had the experience where you tasted something and the taste changed the longer it stayed in your mouth? All right, it would really be a taste change. All of these would be a change that we see. So if you get a taste change, a noise change, a heat change, a radiant light change, a smell change, a color change, these are often indicators that a chemical reaction has occurred. Right. Let's see, maybe let's think for a moment about chemical reactions at Holden Village. What are some chemical reactions that we see around here? I was mentioning to you one that I've noticed from eating a lot of beans and nuts and around here. Methane production, right? Yes. That those beans, I eat them, they react with my enzymes and what have acid in my system and come out the other end as methane. So that's one reaction that I've been thinking about here at Holden. Let's see, how about kaboom? We didn't actually have any pyrotechnics on July 4th here at Holden, but if we had, those would have been chemical reactions. What other chemical reactions can we think of at Holden Village that we might experience?
Well, we, instead of fireworks, they ran their flashlights.
Okay, all right. That's right, that's a chemical change, right? Those electrons are
Batteries.
I should say I'm a DNA biochemist, so you know we get into that world of inorganic stuff. It's a little hard for me, but yeah. Okay, so the turning on the flashlight—that was a chemical change. What are some other chemical changes we see here at Holden? I don't know. I guess if you hang around the kitchen, you probably see a lot of chemistry, right?
Yeah, baked bread.
All right, the bread changes composition from flour into the lovely bread that we have. All right, so really, if you can go about your day and think about these chemical reactions all the time.
Flowers blooming along the trails, and those are all driven by chemical reactions with sunlight and water.
Okay, metabolism, flower metabolism, urea metabolism. Okay, all right. So to a chemist, it's just atoms and molecules reacting, and we can see these reactions very often by sense change. Not always, but often by sense change. And it turns out, gratefully, atoms and molecules only do one other thing, all right? You'd think that with 100-something of them, we'd have lots of different things that go on, but actually, we can break it down to two things. Anybody know what the other thing is that atoms and molecules do?
Right.
That's up here, because we're making bonds. Here we can get a more temporary combination of molecules in having them interact with one another. All right, so let me give you an example. Here I have a model for, anybody recognize this molecule? We've got one kind of atom here and two kinds of atoms out here. Anybody remember this model from their grade school days? Water molecule. All right, so this would be a model for the water molecule. There's the oxygen atom that has eight protons, and it has eight protons in the nucleus with neutrons, and then two and six electrons. Here's our little itty-bitty hydrogen atom with one proton and one electron in the outer cloud. All right, so we have two hydrogens bonded to the oxygen. Here I have another water molecule. All right, and because of this, because we have electrons which are negative and protons which are positive, we can experience a temporary attraction of one molecule for another. So you can see here that we have oxygen of this water attracting. Which atom right here? Hydrogen of this water molecule here. So one other thing that atoms do, molecules do, is atoms as well, is interact with one another. And it's this interaction change, here's no interaction, here's interaction, that leads to change in state. So here's water in the air, right? Here's water when we get liquid, like in Railroad Creek out here, right? And then if I had many more water molecules and the temperature was very cold, we'd have what state?
Ice.
Ice. And so the changes in state is a result of the change in interactions. So the solids have tight interactions. And the gases have very little interaction. And we should say a word about another reason why this is so, and that is because in the gaseous state, the molecules are moving around a lot. So where there's a lot of motion, there can't be very much interaction. Where there's a lot of interaction, there's very little motion. So let's take a minute to play with this idea. Let's put our chemical lenses on and look at the air in this room. Right? What gases do we see in this room? What gas am I letting out?
Water.
Right? You know that because if you held a glass up to your mouth, you could condense that water. Mm-hmm. Right? What other gas am I putting out? Out of here?
Carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide, right? Those carbon atoms in my beans not only come out here as methane, but they also come out here as carbon dioxide. So we might have a tiny bit of methane around here.
Nitrogen.
What gas do we breathe in?
Oxygen.
All right. Any other gases up here? Probably very little. If we lived in down in the city, we'd have problems with sulfur dioxide and NOxes, NO2s. But up here in Holdenware, we have rarefied air. All right, so put your chemical lenses on and look at those atoms and molecules in the room. They're in the gaseous state, so they're not sticking to one another. They're just zooming around the wall, around the room, and occasionally a gas molecule bumps into you, bumps into the wall. Can't you see them?
Yeah.
All right. And if it got very cold here, all of a sudden in the village, in this room, maybe we begin to see the water molecules condensing around our mouths and in our noses and what have you. And that condensation would mean the molecules are slowing down and they're sticking very tightly to one another. All right, so on a hot day like this, I breathe that water out and away it goes, right? If it was a little colder, I breathe that water out and they might find each other and stick to one another. All right, so to a chemist then, all is atoms and molecules that are either reacting or moving. All right, so how's your lens coming? Getting richer, deeper? All right, let's move on to the focal that I wanted to develop. There is a characteristic of atoms and molecules that we witness as we look at molecules doing what they do. All right, there is a characteristic. I wanted to take a few minutes to think about one important characteristic. And I can illustrate this characteristic in the following way. Let's see. All right. I'm going to illustrate it here. Maybe somebody can tell me what I'm attempting to do here. Okay, what I've done, of course, is symbolize one of the things that molecules do, which is, you only got two choices, react, all right? I've broken bonds, right? The bonds here change into CO2, so we've got some change. So this is, I've symbolized a reaction. I'm not quite done with this reaction, though, because I've got four hydrogens here and only two here, so I'm gonna put a two out there, that'll give me four. Now I've got two and two, that's four, so I'm gonna have to put two right here. Anybody know what activity I just went through?
Balancing
equations, right? I don't know what grade level they're doing this in school yet, but it is a sort of a rote activity that chemical educators seem to take their students through all the time, and for a lot of students it is just a pain. However, if you think about what we're trying to show here, it becomes, I think, a lot easier. And that is, what chemists have noticed from studying several reactions is the following idea, that when a chemical reaction occurs, we never lose any atoms. All right, so I'm going to say here, almost always, when a chemical reaction occurs, atoms are not created or destroyed. And of course, this is in a standard chemical text, this would be considered a law. This is called a law of conservation of
matter.
Yeah, matter or mass. Or I like to really just call it the law of the conservation of atoms, because that's what it fundamentally is about. So let's check this out. Have we conserved atoms here is the way I've written it. I started with one carbon here. How many carbons do I end up on this side?
One
carbon, right? Nothing happened to that carbon. It's still here, only it's in a different molecular form, right? Atom hasn't gone away. It's just changed from methane. The molecular form has changed. The carbon dioxide. Right, so the carbon didn't disappear, right? What about hydrogen? How many hydrogens do I have here?
Four.
How many hydrogens do I have in each water? Two, so I have two waters, so how many hydrogens do I have?
Four,
right? The hydrogen atom didn't disappear, I didn't create it, it just changed form. Here it was in the form of methane, here it's in the form of water. How am I doing on oxygen? If I start with an O2 molecule and I take two of them, I have a total of four oxygens, how many do I have over here? I have two in that molecule, two in that molecule, so how many do I have?
Four.
Right? So for all practical purposes, one thing chemists have noticed about molecular transformations is atoms never disappear or are never created. Now, I don't know about you, but this gives me comfort. Whenever I lose something, right? I know those atoms aren't going to disappear. I might lose my candy bar and it might get eaten by my friend, but those atoms that were in my candy bar end up coming out of my friend's mouth as carbon dioxide. All right, so you can take some comfort in the idea that these atoms, they don't disappear for all practical purposes. All right, so that's one very important idea then for looking at the natural world, is to think about the idea that atoms don't get lost, nor do they appear magically for all practical purposes. So now, what's the point? How does this relate to garbology? Remember I said we wanted to apply this to experiences at Holden? How would a chemist explain garbology? Would you like to do that for us?
Well, we're using what you wrote to digest leftover food and food waste, and we end up with water and carbon dioxide, and when you do that, the pieces that were in some of the plants or whatever it is, they just are left in a pile, laying there.
What? And we
can go up in the air.
All right. So the food that we eat, we know that eventually the food that we eat will come out again, in the form of carbon dioxide or in the form of methane, depending on what kind of food it was. Those carbon atoms. What happens if it's,
Also, we don't burn plastics because we don't want to put chlorine atoms into the air. We don't want to put bad atoms, if there's such a thing, into the air to make harmful molecules in the air we breathe.
So the plastics that we've created, those atoms in the plastic, we could convert them to another form, but that form would not be good for us,
right,
in terms of breathing. All right, that all the atoms we have are all the atoms we'll ever get, right? Let's see. What about any other questions about how we can relate this to garbology, or any other thoughts about it? Has anybody done garbology? Do you do garbology? No, don't do that. All right. Mike, would you want to say more about garbology and conservation of atoms?
I know they recycle a lot of atoms, aluminum. They, rather than scatter those atoms in the landfill, they're already there in the form of refined aluminum, so save energy.
What happens to the atoms of the paper trash that you put in the waste basket here at Holden? Anybody else? They get burned, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they turn into carbon dioxide. The carbon atoms in that piece of paper get turned into carbon dioxide, go off into the air. That added into the air. What happens to the carbon atoms of the banana peel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Yep, goes up to the compost pile and gets converted into another molecular form. Right, so one thing we know about our atoms is, for all practical purposes, all we have now are all we've ever had. Right, or... Right, so they don't disappear. They might change molecular form, but our atoms don't disappear. Any questions or comments about this idea of the law of conservation of atoms? So if you lose something, next time you can just say with confidence, I know those atoms are not going to disappear, so I can find what I'm looking for. Right?
Maybe.
Yeah. All right, you want to try one more idea? Or are you getting weary?
Let's try one more.
Okay, let's try one more. I thought we'd try this related to the idea of energy, which involves atoms and molecules. And the best way to think about this idea is maybe to start by just thinking about what we already might know about energy. And a good way is just to think about types of energy. What types of energy are you all familiar with?
Sunlight,
so we have solar energy. I'm sorry?
Hydro.
Okay, hydroelectric? What other kind? What's that?
They got some big things.
That's right, yeah. Hydroelectric plant, right? What other kind of energy can water give us in the ocean? We've got those deep thermal vents where the heat from the inside of the planet is coming up into the ocean. So we've got thermal energy, also just heat. What kind of energy did you mention when you were thinking about uranium? What kind of energy is that?
Atomic energy?
Atomic energy or nuclear energy? Okay, let's make that atomic / nuclear because we can use both of them. What other kinds of energy do we know about? What kind of energy is involved with the flashlight? Okay, radiant energy.
Radiant.
So not only does that include the visible range, but we know what dangerous rays come through the ozone, especially up here. We got UV, UV and ultraviolet. So we've got visible, among other kinds, UV, infrared. What other kind of energy do you think of?
You mentioned the batteries in the flashlight. That's chemical energy.
Okay. Electrochemical energy. What kind of energy is involved in the octane that you put in your automobiles? What happens to that octane?
Just heat.
It gives heat. We get part of it as heat. It starts though as chemical energy. Same as the food that you eat, starts as chemical energy. Let's see if we left anything out. Mechanical energy. What's another term for energy of motion? Something's moving. Kinetic energy. This is. So it's related to mechanical energy, right? If you think about wheels moving in your car, or I discovered the old water wheel up here on the hill I didn't know about. I hadn't seen it. I've been here once before and didn't know that there was an old water wheel. So that if the water wheel was operational, it would have motion, and that would be kinetic energy. What about energy of position? What kind of energy that's called?
Potential
energy. This is the energy of position. See, have we left out any other kinds of energy?
Yeah. Flow.
Okay, flow. Along with motion. Were you thinking of something else?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it's, like flow of fluid in a pipe.
That's right, what happens when Ella Fitzgerald hits a high C and the glass breaks on the commercial? You can think of that as it's a form of radiant energy. But let's just call it acoustical energy. Yeah. All right. Can we think of any other kinds of energy?
Yeah.
You think of any others, Mike? That's my husband. He's my helper here.
That's a bunch of energy.
That's a bunch of different kinds of energy, right?
Yeah.
All right. So we listed types of energy, but that really doesn't answer the question about what is energy. Here we've got types, but that really doesn't say what energy is. Energy has a very curious definition. Does anybody know?
Capacity to do work.
Capacity to do work or give off heat, exactly. It has in its definition, I've heard capacity or the potential to do work or give off heat. So you'll notice we don't say energy is doing work or giving off heat. We say energy is the capacity, the potential. It's sort of something yet unrealized, right? It's
the horse isn't running yet.
But it has the capacity to do work, right? Yeah. It's a very curious idea. That it's not an actual physical thing that you can hold in your hand, but it's something that is a potential or a capacity. All right? Given that, since energy is the capacity or potential, and we know all these different types of energy, we get a pattern from studying these forms of energy, just like we see with atoms. And that would be what? If the law of conservation of atoms, what happens with energy? That's right. It's the same kind of principle. We have a law of conservation of energy. And so what that tells us is we can't make it or lose it. All we can do is what?
Change
it, transform it. The only thing we can do for all practical purposes is to transform it from one form to another. So just like the atoms, the energy doesn't ever disappear. We can't, for all practical purposes, create it out of nothing, right? But rather, what we get are transformations of energy of these different types. So sometimes when I'm out hiking the trails at Holden, I like to think about energy transformations. So let's take a minute to think about some energy transformations here at Holden.
The motion of the water is turned into electricity.
All right, so we've got the hydroelectric, so we've got the kinetic energy of the water is being converted into electricity. And where does this kinetic energy of the water, where does it originate?
That box, way up on
top. Okay, all right. That water actually starts right way up on the top of the hill, of the mountain, on that little itty-bitty hill over there. So the position of the water, the potential energy, gets transformed into the kinetic energy, and we use our mechanical devices and what have you to get electricity out of it. What other energy conversions do we have here in the village?
Food energy.
Kinetic, right? So we've got the chemical energy of food, which we use the apparatus within ourselves, the enzymes and metabolic pathways in ourselves to get kinetic energy. And boy, I was up on the Holden Lake Trail yesterday afternoon, and I got to tell you that gorp really got me down to the bottom, right? There was a moment when I thought, oh, I can't possibly make it. And gobbled up that gorp, converted that chemical energy into the kinetic energy of walking down the hillside. Other forms of energy conversions we have here in Holden Village.
But where's our water supply for the camp? Is that one up on the hill? There's a big tank up there. But
yeah, that's a big, you have stumbled your way up. And
well, that's how we get our water.
What they do, they drain out from that lake that's in that basin that ends up in that box. And in the box, there's a big pipe, and the pipe comes down here. And there's a place where the water that you drink and run this place is tapped off, and pressure is dropped so it won't push the faucets off the wall. And then the rest of it goes through this penstock that runs the electric generator.
Oh.
In the end of the creek.
So it's, well, when they're up here in the winter and the water starts to freeze, that's when they don't have much electricity.
Yeah, because ice doesn't run down over.
Yeah. In the summer, there's so much water running, it's usually...
That water's coming out of like the mine up there, where it looks so white along.
Oh, that's something else.
That's something else.
That's just seepage.
That's seepage. Is it creating some kind of change?
Well, they threw some soda ash or something on that to neutralize acid from the mine, I think.
What gravity is emerging?
You're thinking about changing in position?
Yeah.
All right, so that yesterday we were up at Holden Lake and we could hear a rock sliding down, all right? So the rock had potential energy up at the top, and then as you listen to it, you could actually see the conversion into chemical energy. So that was into kinetic energy. Right? Other energy conversions we might see around here in Holden. You mentioned one in the wintertime. We take the chemical energy of wood and convert it into thermal energy and what other kind of energy? What happens?
Heat.
You get the heat?
Okay.
And then what do you see with your eyes?
Light.
Flame, all right? Smoke too. So the flame would give us radiant energy, and actually that smoke would be another form of chemical energy. So there's one that happens in the wintertime. Other energy conversions. How does a school bus get all the way down to the bottom of the hill and back up again? Right? So that's another form of chemical energy. Is it diesel fuel that they're using in the buses?
I think it's gasoline.
Gasoline? All right, so we've got the energy in the octane of the gasoline tank, which gets converted into kinetic and mechanical and thermal, right? Imagine that old bus engine probably heats up a little bit as it comes up the hill, right? Thermal. I don't know, maybe on a bad day we get a little acoustic, it starts creaking. I don't know. Other energy conversions we can think about here at Holden Village.
Every time somebody yanks on that string on that bell out there, they convert mechanical energy into acoustic.
Okay, all right. So we've got a mechanical into acoustic with the bell. That's great. Other example. You got one?
No.
We're getting down through the bottom of the list, maybe. How about when you flip the light switch? All right, so we've got the hydroelectric plant giving us the electricity to
radiant
energy
or thermal energy if we use it to run a heating element.
Right.
Toaster.
Yeah, the toaster. Gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That thing is running all the time here in Holden. All right. Any other energy conversions we can think about?
I'm trying to think. When we try to walk up the hills, we use a lot of energy, but where does it lose it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, what happens is the...
You give off heat.
Right?
And you sweat.
That's right. So you're using the chemical energy to do work, like the work of walking up the hill. That's right. All right, so what I would encourage you then is maybe today, the rest of today, you can go around the village as chemists and you can think about the atoms and molecules here at Holden Village, and you can also think about the energy conversions all around us. Right? Let's take one more minute here, let's move down to number 4, and maybe think about, so what's this got to do with guiding our feet? What do you think? What's the connection between thinking about atoms and molecules and energy, and the idea of guiding our feet.
What's guiding our feet?
That's the theme for the village this summer.
Good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we should.
Yes.
There we go.
There we go. I should have known.
Well, we don't want to get the wrong results.
We're out in nature.
So, so we don't want to burn plastic, for example. That is...
Okay, so that guiding that you're talking about involves our heads, right? We want to use our heads and what science has taught us so that we can be,
conserve.
Right, we can demonstrate respect for the environment and living organisms. Yeah. All right. So I think what we're doing here is from our feet we go to our eyes, either actually visually or metaphorically, and to our minds. And so when we talk about guiding our feet, we're talking about guiding our eyes, guiding our heads, but what's the part that involves, why should we care about whether or not we burn plastic? What part is that? Is that eyes or head or feet? Heart, right? So I would say when we're talking about guiding our feet, we're talking about guiding our eyes, guiding our hearts, guiding our heads. All right, so I'll just leave you then with that reflection.
Almost sounds like a 4-H
club. Well, you've been really a pleasure to be with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for your thoughtfulness.
I didn't realize.
They should be more chemical energy. That's right. So it's something, isn't it? What we know, what we can know.
Somehow it is.
Well, just a different perspective.
Well, my husband was a chemist for UConn before he became a college professor of English.
Really?
Yeah. So every once in a while he'd run into something and then he'd start in on this kind of thing.
That's great. I love it when people cross the disciplines like that.
Yeah.
Thanks. It was a pleasure working with you.
Well, thank you.
Hey Mike, I want to show you this part that I didn't get into. This idea about law of conservation of energy and law of
whatever the motivation, the different kinds of science gives us a mirror reflection of nature, so that the laws of nature are in nature. We learned that that picture of science just doesn't work. But that's a metaphor that has many functions, most of them political and social, that it really is not a very good description of actually what happens. That what actually what happens is that the descriptions of nature, the theories of nature, very complex would influence all kinds of social, cultural, psychological, ethnic presuppositions.
I think the beware of the text of the Stephen Weinberg talks about the universe as being one that overwhelming hostility. Do you feel the universe is hostile?
I don't think the universe is hostile. I also quote Stephen Weinberg in the same lecture. That's another example. Stephen Weinberg is somebody I quoted in my book on gender and science, also a wonderful book. So the laws of nature are cold and indifferent. We didn't want it to come out that way, it just came out that way. Well, I think that there is a sense in which we did want it to come out that way, that that the language of hostility, of coldness, of indifference is a human language. And that human language is written into our descriptions of nature, into what Weinberg calls the laws of nature.
So this is what?
Written into the very notion of nature.
In what sense?
And law of nature is a very curious construct. It is a proved law. Is the law of nature. Where does the idea of a law of nature come from? And what is the function of a law of nature? The law of nature, the concept of the law of nature comes How does sperm originate from the first realm? First comes from the realm of God. It belongs to nature, originally God's law. Now, in contemporary science, we don't believe in God's laws. But still, the laws have an existence in our imagination, somehow above the phenomena. But the phenomena must conform to the law of nature. And this is very important when you think about Ashley Tanaka's work and how we develop our science. Because what we do is Francis Bacon gave us all kinds of memorable expressions about how we have to invest nature, in that only under the objectivation will reveal her true nature. Well, we do vex nature. We vex nature quite a bit. We twist and conform. It is no easy task to make nature conform to the laws of nature.
Isn't that great?
I think I have a scientist to say that. It is very hard work to get nature to conform to the laws of nature. Nature has natural phenomena have to be structured and constrained and put it in investment to an astonishing degree, and then they will obey the laws of nature. So what is this telling us about the laws? What are laws of nature doing? What is their relation to other kinds of phenomena?
So when Steven Weinberg says that the laws of nature are as impersonal and free of human value as the rules of arithmetic, you're not objecting to the formula as much as you are to the very language, the very use of the word law to describe the operation of nature. Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm objecting to both. I'm objecting to the language of laws. I'm also objecting to the notion that they are as free of human value as the rules of arithmetic. I think it's not true. I think there's nothing. It is a fantasy that any human product could be free of human value. And science is a human product. It's a wonderful, glorious
human product.
But what about nature? Nature is not a human product. It's a natural world.
Science doesn't give us nature. Science gives us a description of nature. Science gives us scientific theories of nature.
And in the description of nature, we assign to that description our own subjective experience.
There is no way of avoiding that. There is no way of... there is no magic lens that will enable us to look at, to see nature unclouded, uncolored by any values, hopes, fears, anxieties, desires, goals that we bring to it. There is no such magic lens. We interact with the world,
we
it's very easy.
We phrased the wall this way. We didn't think about this or that.
That shit.
Now with that old man, that will get changed.
Gender, or ideology of class, or ideology of commitment to military.
We're talking about the Ten Commandments.
Largely, we see how the Bible book helped guide the kind of
after certain times.
So it's
okay to kill.
I wish that was
true.
I wish all the kids were starting to bring more women. I think if we're bringing more women into science now, then it would change. But no, it's much more complicated because these
norms,
social, ideological patterns get imprinted onto the very structure of science. There's a momentum to the development of science. You don't just come in and change it with you. You don't come into science with a different language. First of all, you don't come into science. I mean, that's the first thing. You will be very soon. So the first point is that in order to enter into this world, you have to be re-social. So whether you have a different language or a different set of expectations or a different set of interests because you were socialized as a woman or because you were socialized as a working class, a black, or whether you were socialized as and you grew up in Japan or China, it doesn't matter. When you enter into the world of science, if you want to be a member of this world, you have to learn its language. You have to learn the language of that world. So that's the first point. And the second point is that the language and the goals and the endeavor can have a dynamic of its own. If it is the case, as I believe, if it is the case that the language of science shapes the actual content and what it is, how we explore this wonderful human endeavor, this wonderful human talent, then I think that is far more important than touching the human talent. It's important when the time is important. I don't think it's more important. But there are more, given the tremendous role that science plays in the world we live in, the idea is that science could be redirected, that there could be changes in the way in which science is done and the way in which it moves, the direction in which it moves, that's actually of even greater importance. That's my principal argument. And my principal case, the strongest case for that argument, is the story of Barbara McClintock. I titled my biography of McClintock, A Feeling for the Organism. It wasn't for my agenda that I chose that title. The title was hers. It's her deepest belief that you cannot do good research without a feeling for the organism. A feeling for the organism was her refrain.
But what do you mean about her feeling for the organism?
I mean the ability to identify with the subject of study, to feel kinship with the subject that you're studying, instead of feeling engaged in a battle, in a struggle, in a state of opposition.
Can you really feel that's primarily a female mode of approaching science?
No. I believe that it's been called a female mode of approaching science. I believe it is a human virtue, a human talent. We're talking about empathy, the capacity for empathy. I don't think that women have a form of market sense of empathy. I think that all of us are capable of empathy, although I do think that it's not a talent that is very, very well developed in many men because we're raising it today. But it is precisely because it has been identified as a feminine virtue, as a feminine talent, that it has been excluded from science.
Can you give me some specific examples? I could think it's a very obvious one. I think that the first atomic bomb was called Fat Boy, and it was delivered from the womb of a bomber named Fidel Day, a female delivering the weapon of destruction. But that's probably too extreme example.
Well, it's an extraordinary that metaphor. I mean, what do you make of it? And that was a metaphor that really...
I think that men were at war, and men were scientists who invented the atomic bomb, and they gave it the name that would give something if they were fighting a sweetheart.
Yes, except that the idea of a big metaphor bomb as baby is more than anything that could have been true of, and that carries to me far more import.
As you point out, the bombs with the thrust were called boy babies, and the bombs that were guns were called girls. Story of the mad scientist down in his basement pursuing the secret of life, discovering the secret of life, and then turning the secret of life into something monstrous. It was a story. The stories get at meetings. I've often wondered if this was a woman's view of science, Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein as a parable about how a woman, or perhaps many women, saw science, pursuing perfection and finding instead the monster that destroys the creator.
Except that that's a story, a fantasy that has been embraced by many men. I mean, that story, the popularity of that story, Mary Shelley wrote it, but who reads it? Who reads the story of Frankenstein? That myth, that idea that men in seeking the secret of life, in seeking to the power to create life without
this is a feeling for the organism.
That's really what that story is about. It's the
Karen Cross to legal
life.
Because you have to be able to speak even about your
qualification of appropriated function by men.
You can't understand their position, what their posture is.
That's what the story is about. What is the result in? The result is a monster, not as life, but a monster.
So instead of trying to objectively analyze the situation,
that scene is
a dance inside their shoes.
That scene that And that was my interest in the bonds as babies. But the idea that when men succeed in discovering the secret of life and taking it in their hands, they will produce babies that will be agents of destruction. They will be instruments of death. That is a cultural myth. That's a cultural motif, and not just our own. It's a motif that you find in many, many cultures. That's a very archetypal story. It isn't only Mary Shelley's story. But stories are very powerful, and they speak very deeply to our deepest anxieties and deepest desires. Still, there's a difference between the story and the actual construction, technological structure. And I think these stories have had a lot to do, they tell us a lot about the motivation that has led us to the moment in time when we can all but create life. We are engaged in this activity, in this interaction with nature, natural phenomena. We are seeking knowledge. We are very purposive creatures. Some people will say, Clintock would say, or many of you will say, we're just in it for the understanding, for the sheer understanding. And that's very beautiful, and it's very nice, and I can really resonate with that. But understanding all of those consequences. For example, take the Human Genome Project. The purpose of the Human Genome Project is to give us a complete genome of the human genome. So that is not just for knowledge. Why do you want to give you guys a human genome? Why not the readout of all the molecules that make us I mean, that's going to get involved. But that really was a vision that inspired the early development of classical genetics and early molecular genetics. The idea was to get the future course of human evolution in human hands. And that's a very similar vision that speaks to a kind of control, a degree of control, that one would not think of having in relation to a subject that one had a more erotic, more interactive, more reciprocal feeling engagement with. That is control in the sense of autonomy, in the sense of non-racial. That nature is there to be steered, to be directed, to be the future course of evolution.
Interpreting their mission from God to dominate the earth.
That's right. It is biblical. It is exactly biblical. And scientists have inherited that miracle. That we don't need God anymore because we are human.
But as a biologist, are you not curious about what will be learned from the human genome?
Of course I'm curious. I think that I have no doubt that it will be tremendously interesting and tremendously useful. But it will not, and first I do not think it will fulfill this fantasy. I do not think you can control the course of evolution by getting your hands on the genes, because I don't think the genes are where everything is at.
The public at large, there are people in the public who think of this project to feel yes, the power to create the perfect human being, down the road, maybe able to connect way back in the genetic chain, the potential for disorder in that child that's emerging, so that you'll avoid the Clifton disease.
There is the desire for perfection, there's no doubt about it.
So that's fueling us for a ton of
research. Many, and very productively, you might say, but also dangerously. And that in the 20th century, we can't speak any longer, speak the glories of science as an ethics blessing. It's cost us and it endangers us, and it also empowers us. And the question is whether we can we can harness this new source of power. We can redeploy this wonderful creative resource in ways that will be more productive for the future survival and well-being of humankind.
From her home in Berkeley, California, this has been a conversation.
Berkeley.
Yeah. She's so articulate, isn't she?
If they all have different amounts, different numbers of electrons in their shell, then how do they make bonds with the extra electron? How many electrons do they use? And do they share them equally?
Thanks. Thanks for that. It was a playful moment. How would you characterize
it? I really held back to you, so how would that be different?
Electromagnetic.